from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Colorful Fisherman's Wharf is like the docks at Old Naples. A fish dinner on the wharf is long remembered as an unusual treat. Swarthy fishermen mend their nets and prepare to sail out to sea.
Well, that's a newsreel going back to 1940 and calling attention to Fisherman's Wharf 72 years ago. And just like about everything else in the Bay Area, the wharf has changed dramatically. Coming up on Forum, the National Archives has released long-awaited raw data from the 1940 census, providing us with a snapshot of America at that time. What do the numbers tell us about life in the Bay Area in 1940, and how have things changed? We'll take all that up in the hour ahead, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Monday, the National Archives released the data from the 1940 census, the personal records of 132 million Americans and what they were doing, where they were living, what kind of income they were generating, on the 2nd of April, 1940. And the 1940 census was, in fact, the first census to ask about personal income. Average salary for a man back then was $956, and only 3.8% of women 25 or older had a college degree, compared, by the way, to 27.9% in 2010. Women earned half the salary of men, and the country was half the size it is today, with dramatically less racial diversity. Far more people between 20 and 34 were married, and there were far fewer toilets and much less electricity. California in 1940 was tied for fourth with Ohio. Actually, it was probably below that, as fifth at the nation's most populous state, since now the nation's most populous state. And a census is required each decade for apportionment for the House of Representatives. For confidential reasons, it takes 72 years before the data can be released. The first census was taken back in 1790. In this Forum Hour, we want to discuss the 1940 census and what we have learned from it and the picture it provides us of the then Bay Area. With us in studio is Marcy Goldstein. She's director of the National Archives of San Francisco. They're based in San Bruno, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Kevin Starr, professor of history at the University of Southern California. His latest book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge, now in paperback, born in San Francisco in 1940, and also our preeminent California historian. Good to have you here, Kevin.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be here.
Charles Fracchia is also with us, founder and president emeritus of San Francisco Museum and Historical Society. He has written five books on San Francisco history. His latest is When the Water Came Up to Montgomery Street, San Francisco During the Gold Rush, born and raised in San Francisco. Welcome, Charles Fracchia.
Good to be here.
Good to have you all here. And Marcy Goldstein, let me begin with you. And well, we should talk about the fact that this is now – how many hits did you get when this was released? That's the first question I wanted to ask.
By the second day, we had 65 million hits.
So it's just fascination with people finding their roots and genealogy and all that. And it's available. It's available in digital now, huh?
Absolutely.
What is available?
Well, you can go on to the National Archives site and you can search the 1940 index – if you know the enumeration district your ancestor or friends registered in. And that's a bit of a task. The census has not been alphabetized yet, but we have a list of suggestions of things you need to prepare yourself, such as, do you know the address of where the ancestor lived? Do you have family letters? You can look in old telephone books at the public libraries. But if you're lucky enough to actually know the address, you can look up the enumeration district. There are enumeration maps. And then you can get to the roles of who was interviewed in that district street by street.
Actually, I had someone who we'll be talking to in a moment do that for me, courtesy of our senior editor, Dan Zoll. And
that's the easiest way, having someone do it for you.
Well, the picture we get, though, I mean, from your perspective, we'll hear details from Kevin and Charles, but we were entering into kind of an information age of its own kind. We had all the problems we have now, but particularly problems of the Depression still, and coming out of the Depression and really on the brink of war.
Well, from our perspective, and again, nobody has had the chance yet to do a statistical survey, which is what will really, in the end, reveal what this was all about. But we know from other information sources that this was a time of great mobility. People were moving across the country to the West because of the Dust Bowl, because of the Depression. You're beginning to see the preparation kind of subconsciously for the war. You have two naval bases, construction bases opening at Hunts Point and Mare Island, where they constructed most of the ships that were used in the Pacific. Part of them were also, when we were in the war, they were for the repair of ships that came back. But you see the beginnings of the sea effort kind of picking up. We haven't officially been in the war, but people who, with that background, are starting to migrate to the San Francisco area.
Huge influx of people from other places. In fact, we had Isabel Wilkerson on. We'll talk later with an African American genealogist. A lot of blacks, African Americans, coming up from the South from that great migration. Well, Michael Nolan is a San Francisco resident. He's also a genealogist, and he has used the newly released 1940 census data to research his street in Bernal Heights in San Francisco. And Michael, thanks, by the way, for bringing to my attention. I got the street address where my parents lived in Cleveland, and I thank you for searching that out for me.
You're very welcome. Grateful
for that. But what did you learn about your street? It doesn't quite look like it does now, does it?
I just want to say it was very nice to meet your parents.
Yeah, well, I would say reciprocal, if I could speak for them posthumously.
All right. So I live on a block on Elsie Street, and I am looking at the 1940 census of my block right now, sitting in my kitchen. And it's interesting to see, you used the term before, the kind of snapshot it provides and how different it is from the people who now live on this block in terms of occupations, educational grade, ethnicity, salary. I mean, it's information rich. This particular census is great. So, for example, here are the occupations. Tavern owner, food packer, longshoreman, baker, shoe repairman, building watchman, plasterer, foundry molder, cab driver, another tavern owner, a curtain folder, and a bacon packer. So all working class positions.
And now they're all working with Google and up until recently Yahoo, I guess.
Right. There isn't one software developer on the block, and now there are many. The educational grade. To look at my particular house, and I've actually met one of the people who was in the census. Her name is Frances Mastro. She came here to visit the house several years ago. She's now 85. In this census, she's 13. Her father is Italian, and he's working in a lock factory. My guess is they worked at Schlaglock down towards Visitation Valley. So her father's 42 years old. He achieved a sixth grade of education. He was only employed for 26 weeks in the previous year and earned a grand total of $754. His wife, Mary, 33 years old, achieved fourth grade education, worked for 42 weeks, and made $1,000. I just want to mention, when the daughter came to the house about 5 years ago, she asked if she could come in. And I said, of course. And she said, is the basement floor still dirt? I said, no, it's been cemented over. But she said her father used to make wine in the basement, and I'm sure supplemented his income that way.
And Michael Nolan, again with us by phone, is a San Francisco resident genealogist and has used the newly released 1940 census to research his street in Bernal Heights. And thank you for joining us. It's good to get that snapshot of the snapshot from you of your street in Bernal Heights.
Thank you.
And, in fact, Kevin Starr, we're talking not only about a lot of working-class people in San Francisco then, largely working-class people, but people really from, Italy, Austria, many, many immigrants, especially European immigrants.
Well, by 1910, some 60% of San Franciscans were foreign-born. It had the highest ratio, not absolute numbers, obviously, compared to New York or Cleveland or Chicago, but the highest ratio of foreign-born. So he mentioned the Italian, of course, the North, not just North Beach, but the whole Crocker Amazon area was extremely Italian. Petrel Hill was very Italian and Russian. It was quite a an ethnic city, a foreign-born
polyglot, we used to say.
Yes, immigrant city. And Mr. Nolan mentioned Schlade Lock. Of course, Schlade Lock just signifies the whole industrial culture, the waterfront. Schlade Lock employed over 1,200 people, to include my father. It was locally owned, as were most of the major companies here, locally owned. People worked at Simmons Mattress. People worked at Schilling Spice. People worked on the waterfront. So there was there were a lot of jobs, blue-collar jobs here. It was a whole different kind of America.
No freeways.
Absolutely not. No freeways. If you went down to Peninsula, Charles grew up on the Peninsula by the late 1940s, and if you went down there, you went on El Camino Real.
Also, the World's Fair year we're talking about here, right?
Well, that's a big year.
Big deal.
Big deal at 39-40, and the beauty of that fair rising up on Treasure Island like Atlantis coming from the sea, and it beautifully designed by people like Timothy Pfluger, Ralph Stackpool, George Kellum. I mean, it was a golden age of architecture in California, and all those architects worked on various projects there. And then the lighting was exquisite. It was really theatrical quality of Art Deco coloration lighting. And it must have been magic. I was born, but I don't remember seeing it. But people who do remember it talk about just seeing it at night glowing in the middle of the darkness of the bay.
You think about Art Deco, then Treasure Island.
Absolutely. Well, Treasure Island, Timothy Pfluger did that big hangar there, that central administration building, and that's still considered an absolute masterpiece. City College building. It was a golden age of high rises from the earlier period, but the downtown San Francisco had some very distinguished buildings: the Russ Building, the Bush, the Standard Oil Building, etc. It was the city had a, and you Mr. Nolan mentioned this, and you mentioned it also. The archivist mentioned about the war coming on. There was a sense of almost delusional serenity that even though the war had broken out in Europe, that somehow we could escape it. And it had a kind of pastoral quality, an idyllic quality those 2 years. Maybe denial that this war would eventually get us into it.
But you've characterized this period also as a high quality of life for San Franciscans. What do you mean by that?
Well, as early as 1907, Montgomery Shuler, the architectural critic coming out here, said he'd never seen working people live so well. He makes reference to the Victorian houses, and just look at the roll call that Michael just gave us of working people living in homes that today, if they started $1 million, you're getting a bargain now. And those homes were all by working people, with flowers, with backyards, with adjacent parks, with a beautiful public school system, a very flourishing and very accessible Catholic school system, because you had sisters, nuns teaching. You could go to a Catholic school, $10-$15 a semester for a private school education. It was really high quality of life.
Yeah, you wanted to say something here, Marcy Goldstein?
It's interesting to see the juxtaposition of this thriving city, blue-collar industry coming and developing, and yet right at the foot of San Francisco, you have orchards, farmyards. San Bruno was all orchards at the time. And now, of course, you look at that, that's all industrial. It's all suburban.
I remember somebody showing me a picture from Life magazine. It was 1947, and it was commuting to the wilderness, Mill Valley, mm-hmm. California. Charles Frege, let's bring you into this. This is a Republican city, too, which a lot of people may find hard to believe, but it was.
From 1911 until the mid-1960s. A straight stream of Republican mayors of San Francisco, and largely the Board of Supervisors being Republican as well.
And a kind of, oligarchy. I mean, it was pretty much run by ethnic groups, Italians and Jews, wasn't it?
It was. Throw the Irish in there as well.
And the Irish. And in fact, there's still that 3I group that gave me the honor of honoring me 1 year. The Italians, the Irish, and the Israelis, they call themselves. everybody used to show up at that.
Given the chaos in city politics today, I mean, it's amazing to realize that things were decided by this disparate group. You had the unions, you had the various ethnic groups, that really ran this city. I was just telling Kevin earlier the story that when the city was buying Candlestick Park for the Giants in the 1950s, that there was a lot of opposition because it was a kind of a flim-flam deal. And they got together, the mayor, George Christopher, the last Republican mayor of San Francisco, got together a group of just that oligarchy that I mentioned up at the Pacific Union Club, brought in a few cases of scotch. When the scotch is done, the deal was done, and you never heard about it again. You
know? On a handshake, as they used to say?
On a handshake, exactly.
And the neighborhoods were really undergoing change at this time, too.
Well, at this point, the neighborhoods are still pretty solid, reflecting what had been going on, actually, since the 19th century. And that is the ethnic neighborhoods Kevin mentioned earlier, Italians in North Beach and in the Marina by this time, Crocker Amazon, the Excelsior, Potrero, and so forth. So you had that. Then you had the Irish, particularly in the Mission, strong Irish presence. And then the other, those are the two big groups. Germans by this time had been pretty much assimilated.
Chinese were all totally in Chinatown.
Every Chinese, no matter how wealthy, no matter how prominent, always in Chinatown. So that, of course, that's the final hurrah. I mean, that's after World War II. You begin to get tremendous changes. African Americans coming in, mentioned earlier, and that became about 14% of the city was African American. It's now 4%, smallest percentage of African Americans in any major U.S. city. So these are the shifts that have come around in the last 75 years.
And you describe public transportation as terrific at this time.
Terrific, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it was a different world. And by the way, let me open up the phone lines because it's fascinating not only to look back, of course. What did Faulkner say? The past is not really the past. It's not even past or something like that, Quentin Compson. I'm going to give a phone number here and maybe get some thoughts from some of you and reflections about how much things have changed. And you may have questions about what we've learned as a result of the census and just about the census itself. Anyway, our toll-free number is available, and you can use it now and feel free to do so. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone call, so please feel free to join the program. Again, it's toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to us, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And another way to communicate with us is through Facebook. Marcy Goldstein, why the 72 years confidentiality on these censuses? I'm just out of curiosity. I think many people might have. Why do we have to wait to be septuagenarians before we could open up these?
The original kind of difference of opinion was between the National Archives that wanted to release everything to the public and the Census Bureau, who really wanted to keep everything confidential permanently because they were looking at statistical trends. So fortunately, a compromise was reached because it was assumed by the time you were 72, you would probably be dead. Looking at that again with the increased longevity of the boomers and, 72 probably is no longer quite as valid as it was back then. And it's more like 100 years if you want to be sure that anything private and confidential or detrimental to a person, that person is no longer alive.
Isn't there still some concern now about identity theft?
Absolutely. And at the National Archives, if you are looking into a record that is specific to a person, many of what we call the alien files, which are Asian of a wide variety, that document and also, I might say, we're going to be opening a peculiar set of the A files for people who are 100 years or older, and it shows you all the information about anyone who touched the federal government coming into the country, leaving the country. This is a different set of files, but the theory behind it is if you're 100 years old, you're pretty safe. But where there is private information, in our prison records, Alcatraz, where there's something detrimental to the person's reputation, we do screen that out. So you can look at your own ancestors, but in certain files, we screen out privacy issues for living relatives that appear in the records. So there is a good deal of security before you can access things in a general way beyond your own family.
Kevin Starr, let's go more again about the picture of what things look like at this period. You know, all the pictures in my head are of men wearing hats.
Well, yes. Downtown Market Street, for instance, where you could have your photograph taken, people would, you wouldn't go downtown unless women were dressed properly and wore a hat, gloves, etc. So there was a higher decorum. And this is, goes across all the different socioeconomic backgrounds, too. There just was an expectation that if you went to a church or synagogue, you put a coat and a tie on, you did the best you could. And so there was a higher level of decorum. At Lowell High School, which was founded in the 1850s, the teachers there were really professors. I mean, they were very stable and very highly respected people who dressed properly—not properly—that shows a little bias on my part as a septuagenarian.
Oh, you're wearing your bow tie.
Exactly. You know, I was just going to make Michael something. It's just a footnote to what Charles was talking and what you just said about oligarchy. Think of the companies: Bank of America, Fireman's Fund, Schlade Lock, Schilling Spice, Del Monte, Matson Lines, MJB Coffee. All those companies are locally and hiring people. I remember even as a boy in the 40s. Smelling the coffee being roasted there south of Market. And then the Jewish community was entering into its third generation of the third generation was getting its start or getting into high gear, and they would be the last to manage these great companies which their ancestors, their grandparents had founded. And by the 1970s, 80s, those companies would be sold out to international conglomerates. It's not always, not Levi Strauss, but a good percentage of these companies. I'm thinking about the Zellerbacks, the Brandensteins, et cetera, the people from who were really the setting up the pioneer businesses.
They were the pioneer businesses, yes. Yeah. And Charles, we had four newspapers back then, too?
We did. The Chronicle, of course, the Examiner, News, Call Bulletin. It was a rich newspaper town.
And I think NBC was where the radio action was in this town.
Right? That's right.
Downtown.
Right downtown.
Yeah.
That I can still remember as a boy going and sitting in on the various radio programs. This was pre-TV, obviously, that you could just sit there and watch the actors on stage.
What about One Man's Life, Kevin Starr?
Well, One Man's Family was, of course, Carlton Morris.
One Man's Family, I'm sorry.
It was, that's part of dovetails with what you were just talking about, the radio, because it was a program with a family living in Seacliff and the different things they would do. And when there was a crisis in the family, they would go sit out on the wall and meditate on the bay, the Golden Gate, etc. And Carlton Morris did that. The Barbers embodied what later be known as family values in an unmistakably San Francisco context.
And you can unmistakably identify this as Coleman Hawking's performing Body and Soul, one of the big hits of 1940. We're going to continue this exploration of not only the senses and what it reveals. It's a real portal to the past. But talk about then and now, and certainly welcome your calls. And you can join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Not just nostalgia, real history here with really our preeminent historians, Kevin Starr, Charles Frakia, and we also have Marcy Goldstein here as director of the National Archives. They're based in San Bruno. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The National Archives has released the long-awaited raw data from the 1940 census, providing us with a view of America at that time, and we're finding out what the numbers tell us about life in the Bay Area in 1940, discussing how things have changed. You get a remarkable sense of, well, a place in transition in many respects, moving into a different era, the time being that of the World's Fair and that of the war, around the brink of war, and suddenly getting racial diversity and getting people coming here from all over, from the Dust Bowl, and a lot of African-Americans from the South. In fact, I want to get Nika Smith into this conversation. She's an outreach and education chair for the African-American Genealogical Society of Northern California. Nika Smith, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess This has been quite an eye-opener for you and for many in the African-American community, particularly in terms of just going back and finding out where folks came from and what they were doing and how educated they were, even for you personally, huh?
Oh, yes, definitely. One of the most eye-opening things that I found on this census was a column that was labeled the highest level of highest grade level completed. And for one of my great-grandparents, that was just the third grade. And his wife never went to school. And so, you know, for me being a college graduate, to see, you know, that information next to my family's names, you know, it's something that I grew up learning about, but to actually see my own family's names there with, you know, only having a third grade education, it just completely blew my mind.
Yeah, that's very affecting, I'm sure. In fact, aren't you taking some of the census data into West Oakland for some of the African-American youth there?
Yes, yes. I have a program I work with Supervisor Keith Carson called the Ancestral Project. And we've been, you know, kind of billing this 1940 census a lot with the youth, you know, telling them, you'll probably know someone on there. And so, you know, for them to be able to read it and look at it and actually see a name that they've heard of, you know, that's so exciting. And so, you know, I'm kind of culling through everything, learning the little intricacies of how to access data so they can get to stuff a little bit quicker than most of us have been able to.
What does it do for them? I mean, tell us about kind of the reactions you've had or just how it illuminates their lives.
Oh, my goodness. You know, the racial designation category, you know, we could spend two or three classes on that alone, you know, because they identify as being African-American or black. And so when they see colored or Negro on official documents, that offends them. You know, they don't understand it, you know, so then we have to go into a conversation about how racial designations have changed for not just African-Americans, but a lot of people over time. And some things are socially acceptable, you know, that were socially acceptable then are not socially acceptable now.
So this becomes a history lesson. Really.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Genealogy is psychology. It's sociology. It's history. It's a lot of things. But really, it's the story of you. So that's what makes it so dynamic.
Nika Smith, again, is Outreach and Education Chair for the African American Genealogical Society of Northern California. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
And here's Al, who writes, in 1940, when we moved to Alameda, the population was 38,000 with one African-American family. By 1943, it was 107,000, nearly 50% African-American due to recruitment in the South for war work. Another listener, Zoe, writes, I just returned home to the Bay Area from a week's vacation in New York City. Took a stop at the Tenement Museum on the Lower East Side, where I went on a walking tour of a tenement restored to what it looked like in the 1900s and 1940s. It was like walking through a time machine into my grandfather's childhood flat. To anyone traveling to New York, I highly recommend the museum, and I wonder if Forum's guests today know of any similar plans that may be brewing in San Francisco. Any walking tours of painted ladies or other buildings restored to World War II era?
Charles? There are a lot of walking tours of the Painted Ladies. San Francisco never had a big tenement operation as did New York and other East Coast and Midwestern cities. So I don't think we're going to get that here. But, yeah, Painted Ladies, definitely. There are lots of walking tours.
And Marcy Goldstein, here's a listener, Dan in San Rafael, says, unfortunately, the data is not presented in an accessible manner. When you search by location, the default street name is all and cannot be changed. There are no maps showing the enumeration districts, only hard-to-correlate physical descriptions. Also, the census information is handwritten and somewhat difficult to read. And Michael Nolan did yeoman work here, as I said, with my family, but I think this. I saw the graph. He's right.
Absolutely.
These enumeration districts can drive you mad, I think.
Well, there are, some of the enumeration maps are available. What we've tried to do, especially at our location in San Bruno, is to provide blow-ups of maps from the 1930s so that you can get some idea. There is a conversion table available, I believe, on Steve Moore's site. Of census information so that if you can locate an address in 1930, it converts it to the enumeration district for 1940.
Steve Moore is M-O-R-E?
S-E. So
people, Steve Moore is M-O-R-S-E.
Right. So
it's not like Google Maps, that's for sure. Right?
No, it's presented in its raw form, so you are actually seeing what was written down. And it is kind of interesting to compare today to a Google search and how, you know, when you do history and genealogy, you have to deal with what existed. Most of them had great handwriting, but it is hard to work your way through, which is, again, why we suggest you have as much information about your family and neighbors as you can when you attempt a search. Now, that's going to get easier. Ancestry and Family Search are, I believe, indexing by name, but that's going to take up to a year, maybe more. So for the moment, we are working, you know, with what we have and letting people go through it. We can, at your local archives, which again is in San Bruno, you can come and have those pages blown up so that they might be a little easier to read. And if you go through the National Archives sites, it's free.
Let me go to our callers, but just a quick question for you, Charles Fracchia. If you lived, like, say in San Mateo or San Rafael, South Bay, East Bay, it was not so easy coming into the city, even though
people No, it did. Wasn't. I mean, my parents had moved down to the peninsula, as Kevin mentioned, in the 50s, and you came in either on Potrero or you came in by the Bayshore was around at that time, or the El Camino. And it was a long, laborious journey to come into San Francisco. On the other hand, there were cows. Where the airport is today, one building where the airport is today, one airport building. Tremendous number of orchards. San Mateo still had these huge estates that were built in the 19th century. It's a very different world. And, you know, Mike, I just want to add something. You know, as I thought about this program last night, I was thinking to myself that, do you realize I'm 74 years old, and I sound like an old codger sometimes, but the reality is the time that has went by between the founding of the Republic in 1789 and the beginning of the Civil War in the 1860s is the time that I've been alive. And when I think of what the changes I've seen, and you compare that, Kevin talked about the price of homes in Bernal Heights. I mean, these are powerful changes that have experienced during this almost three quarters of a century.
Yeah, I always remember when my father and mother would come out to visit, my father would say, you know, because he'd spend time with me and my brother out here, and he'd say, the time went by like a jet plane, you know, because jet plane was something he grew up with that was so much emblematic, really, of how fast things had moved and how fast they're moving now, of course, with Silicon Valley and all that's being invented there. It staggers the imagination. Let me get some callers on. We'll go first down to Menlo Park. And Phyllis, you're on. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yes, I couldn't resist calling. Kevin Starr knows me, Phyllis Butler. I wanted to mention something that you all forgot, I think. Nobody mentioned Ghirardelli. My great-grandfather had worked for him as a confectioner. I looked him up in the old city directories. And or did you mention? And I wonder what Ghirardelli was. Was it a factory? It hadn't become the tourist center it is yet. And the other thing I wanted to mention was my uncle, Carl Miles, had an advertising agency, and my father worked for him. And a funny story, you didn't get paid for being on, he was on the board of supervisors, and you didn't get paid, I don't think, then. And my father, you loved to tell the story that they'd say, well, why do you spend all that time doing that heavy work? But he got all the printing business for the whole city. And he said, well, of course, that's why I'm on the Board of Supervisors. If I didn't get the business, I wouldn't do it.
Well, Phyllis, thank you for that call. What do we know about Ghirardelli, Kevin or Charles?
Well, the company starts in the 1850s and moves out to Ghirardelli Square as the chocolate manufacturer in the 1890s. A major San Francisco icon company, as we know, now owned by, as Kevin pointed out, owned by somebody else far, far away.
I thank the caller, and we go right to you. Harold, you're on with us. Good morning.
Well, my family, my grandfather came to San Francisco in 1903. In the 40s, they were part of the Jewish contingent in the Fillmore District, and I grew up in the Richmond, and I'm proudly still on the board of the Alumni Association at George Washington, and I have some real fond memories of those days. My grandfather used to have stories. Oh, I could go on for hours and hours and hours.
Well, unfortunately, not on our program, but Kevin Starr wanted to ask you something.
No, I just was, he mentioned the Jewish community in the Fillmore District. With the earthquake and fire in 1906, a lot of the Jewish community, which was centered on Van Ness Avenue and Lower Pacific Heights, went into the Fillmore District, and that was an incredibly flourishing Jewish neighborhood, as was the Haight-Ashbury when my parents were living there in 1940 on Page Street. The stores, Axelrod's, and the delicatessens, etc. So you had a whole migration up, and eventually it solidified with the construction of Temple Emmanuel in the mid-1920s, etc., and you have a whole wonderful district, but a Jewish district, which includes, incidentally, all people of different classes, working Jewish people, aristocratic owners, etc. It was a very diversified community.
I think the only Jewish ghetto now is Seacliff.
Well, that's part of the pattern. That's part of that pattern.
Well, there was, for a while, there was a little sort of shtetl or something like that around Noriega. I don't know if you recall. I'm going back to the early 70s here. Here's Carol, who goes back, too, and says, oh, my goodness, you're bringing back so many memories. I was 11. We lived in the Richmond District. Yes, we dressed with decorum. My parents were Republicans. Their parents were immigrants. We used the streetcar to get around. Jack, Doc, and Reggie were the topic of conversation, not Dancing with the Stars. We went to the beach all the time. My father did business based on his word, not a contract, and so on and so on and so on. I must look up the census. Here's a comment on our website. How far back to these National Archives date? If I wanted to find out records of my immigrant great-grandfather entering Angel Island, would I be able to do that? Well, there are archives at Angel Island, too.
There's archives at Angel Island, but the National Archives in San Francisco has all the records of who emigrated, the ship manifestos, which listed who was on what ship, any naturalization that took place, any interviews. There are workshops on the Chinese Exclusion Act, and all of those records are also available. So anybody who emigrated through Hawaii, San Francisco, Guam, we have the records of Samoa. So anybody who's coming that way, and incidentally, a large number of Russians and Russian Jews are coming out during this period. And all of those records are at the National Archives.
Well, we have done a lot of programs on different facets of immigration, including Asian American immigration. And Charles, you were saying earlier that Chinatown was where all the Chinese lived. What about from other Asian nations? Immigrants were coming from all over, but were they coming so much from Japan or Korea or Cambodia, Thailand?
No. If there were, there were minuscule small numbers. The Japanese had, of course, were established in the Fillmore area, Japantown, which got hustled out.
Weren't far away from the camps, unfortunately.
Right, 1942. The groups that we see a lot of today from Southeast Asia and so forth, there may have been a handful, but no great numbers.
Kevin Starr, what about the Asian American community here at this time?
Well, I think just the Chinese community is the dominant one. It's small, and it's on the verge of a big change. Well, first of all, Chinatown was very flourishing to include Charlie Lowe's Forbidden City, a Chinese nightclub with an all-Chinese chorus review, et cetera. So you had the beginnings of with the war that would take some 3,000 Chinese Americans from the greater Bay Area, et cetera. And during World War II, the armed forces did not segregate Chinese. There was one all-volunteer Chinese unit that went over with the Flying Tigers, but that was volunteer just to show the Chinese that we had Chinese in this country and that we were friendly. So that's a community on the verge of an incredible internationalization. They came back from the war. You talk about World War I, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? The Chinese community is dynamically changed on the verge of a dynamic change. And you can catch some of these in the novel Flower Drum Song, which later, of course, becomes the musical, et cetera, the various generations of Chinese at this period.
What about the theater at this time? You mentioned Hidden Secret City and Hidden City and everything, but what about the theater in general?
Well, the Kern and the Geary were our
that
first.
That was it.
Well, it's just about it. The Kern and the Geary go back to right after the earthquake in 1909, 12. They're certainly up and around by 1911, 12. And so you have that there. But you also have shows and reviews at the theaters. So you had a mixed genre. There could be a kind of musical performance and a little sort of lingering suggestion of vaudeville, even in neighborhood theaters.
And was this as much a city of international cuisine? Was it becoming that way? Or?
Well, you know, Michael, I've got this wonderful book by Ruth Thompson, The Eating Around San Francisco, which is exactly 1939, 1940. And it's amazing. The older restaurants tend to be Italian, and many of them are still with us today, the Fior d'Italia. And then there was that older cuisine that you see at Jack's, at Tadish's, at Sam's, which is basically a French or a Croatian kind of seafood-oriented cuisine, which is very, very powerful. And then places like May's Oyster House are still with us. And I always remember as a boy in 1945, 46, going by Bernstein's Fish Grotto and seeing the great big ship front that came out from there. It's just it's amazing how many of these restaurants are still with us. And the last of the old great restaurants, like the Fly Trap and et cetera, are still with us to this day. They've gone through permutations. It always was a restaurant town. It was noted for that way in the 19th century that people ate out a lot. And I think that culture was very well done. Another thing, too, in this period is that people used hotels for socializing. Today we tend to think the tourists go to the hotels, and the people that live here don't go to the hotels. But in those days, the Palace, the St. Francis, the Fairmont, the Mark Hopkins, the Sir Francis Drake, the Whitcomb, the Taylor Hotel, which is now owned by Hastings Law School.
It's all part of the social culture.
It's part of the social culture. People go to nightclubs there, bars, the patent leather room at the Fairmont, et cetera. So people use their institutions. People use Fisherman's Wharf, too. The restaurants on Fisherman's Wharf, Aliotto's, the Franciscan, Scoma's, were used by local people.
And also, you still have the traditions dating back to the Victorian times of the high tea and social literary groups meeting, and that happens in the hotels.
And Frank is joining us. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Michael. Hi. I was born in 1940, and like a lot of old-timers, I know a lot of the changes that took place in the Bay Area and in the country in the 30, 40 years after 1940. But I'm interested about your guest talking about the changes that took place in the Bay Area in the 30 or so years before 1940. I mean, the 1940 census reflects life in America and the Bay Area at the end of the 30s. What about life, the changes in the area between, say, 1906 and 1940? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the call. And, of course, I'll suggest that you read Kevin Starr and Charles Frank Hammett, I mean, because they lay a lot of this out in their work. But want to jump in here, Charles?
Well, you know, for me, 1940, when I heard about this program, I was excited because this is truly a pivotal year. It's the end of the Depression, just before the Second World War breaks out. The city very much mirrored the 19th century. So there was not as much change that the gentleman's talking about. Now, 1940 comes. 1941, the war breaks out. Cesco is totally transformed. Highest peak of populations, 1948, 850,000. People, then the clients into the 600,000, and then, of course, the changes that come around in the 1960s. So the big, it was still somewhat, I hate to use the word static, but it was still pretty much of a static city, very much contained because of the lack of mobility that marked the Depression. But so this is a major year for the harbinger of change.
And we'll bring more callers in just a moment, but I want to also I'm getting, you know, kind of a detailed picture here, and you can from the census, actually. It brings so much into focus. But let's go back, since the caller mentioned the years before, over a million people, I think it's important to point out, came in the 30s out of rural poverty in the Dust Bowl that you mentioned before, Marcy Goldstein. So it's not only you're seeing all these immigrants who talk about where they come from in Europe, but a lot of what Steinbeck wrote about. I mean, it's all...
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting to note that the census itself asks you where you lived 5 years before. So you see a lot of movement in the 5 years from 1935 to 1940. And that's capturing the Dust Bowl movement and the agrarian.
Yes.
So they begin to ask about that. They're talking about if you're unemployed, how long have you been unemployed? They're asking where there's a certain percentage, I believe it's 5 to 10% of the census, that asked additional questions. So they were called supplementary questions, and they asked you where your grandparents were born, tracking movement and immigration within the country even further back. It asked you more about education because that was becoming more available to people. So there's a lot of things in the census that are beginning to pay attention to things that will become social issues. They're asking women, although not men, if you've been married more than once and how many times, which I found very interesting. The head of the household is always considered the authority. So, for example, if the husband was unemployed but the woman, the wife was working, it was the husband's unemployment status that really took precedence. And interestingly enough, this is one of the last censuses where the enumerators or the people taking the census estimated what your race, color, religion were rather than you self-identifying. So
most people were also married at this time. If they were between the ages of 24 and, say, 35, I mean, they were almost inevitably married. Yeah.
So it's very interesting that they're starting to ask about divorce and multiple marriages and...
Michael, you mentioned the Dust Bowl people, and to this day, there's a word that I won't use as a native San Franciscan. In the 1940s, it's the word begins with O, and I won't use it because it's like the N-word. It's just not to be pronounced because it represented a kind of racial prejudice against a certain kind of poor white person. 1940, I think, exactly is the date that Erskine Caldwell's Tobacco Road came out.
That's right.
So you have this kind of demonization of those people as kind of less than fully human, and the word, the O word, was used against them, et cetera, and it became very tense during World War II in the shipbuilding factories, et cetera. The relationship,
migration from the Dust Bowl, yes. Really after 1940, the years of World War
Union,
but then we had Oklahoma, where the whole different perspective. Actually, you're talking about Google Maps before. John writes, "You can see San Francisco as it looked in 1938 on Google Earth, not 1940, but close." Another listener, Karen, writes, "I moved to the Excelsior 3 years ago. I moved into a small house on my landlord's property. He's lived there his whole life. He's in his 70s, and his parents had the house before him. It's been so great learning about the history of the neighborhood. He still refers to the individual houses and the original owner's names, you know, right past the Bagalucci house, across from the Cecchi house. The street seemed to be 100% working-class Italian, and it probably was." Also, from Annette, we found her through our Public Insight Network. She says, "Both sets of my grandparents immigrated from the northern Italy to Marin County in the early 1900s. One grandfather came to work on the Tiburon Railroad. The other opened a blacksmith shop in San Rafael. One grandmother left Italy to escape growing silkworms and came to San Francisco, San Rafael, to find a better life. My other grandmother was a mail-order bride who was detained at Ellis Island, then settled in San Rafael." And on our website, listener asks, "How can I find out who was living in my house from the census? I cannot see any data on the street numbers. Has the street number changed from the 1940s until today?" And there we are again, Marcy, with this whole quandary about how you track these things down.
Well, again, you can look on the enumerator district maps with some difficulty. It's going to be easier. And you will see what streets and what houses were listed. Occasionally, the street names change. Then you're really kind of lost. But it is possible to look up the location rather than the person.
Well, it's hard enough sometimes using MapQuest
yes.
In terms of changing names and so forth. Let me get Beth on here. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi there. I've never called in, so I'm a little nervous. So I'm just going to blast this out. It might be more of a statement than a question, but my great-aunt Mona, she was Mona Sargent at the time. Back in the 30s and 40s, she owned Mona's 440 Club in North Beach. And it was famous, the tagline was sort of, "Where girls will be boys." So sort of in the spirit of Pinocchio's, Mona's had women who basically dressed up as men. And Mona, though, was married to Jimmy Sargent, who was a Cal Berkeley football player or something. So she was just a bon vivant. And she was from so I'm actually in the process of gathering information about that era, and specifically about my great aunt Mona.
Well, you've blasted out very well there, and I think the census may be of some assistance to you, and so, of course, might Kevin Starr.
Well, Mona's always shows up in now histories of the gay liberation movement. I mean, it was a very pioneering place for lesbian, didn't even identify themselves as such, but it was a very important gathering point.
Was it Mattachine Club type?
Well, Daughters of Bilitis was the lesbian
Daughters
group,
of Bilitis,
yes.
That's right.
And so every time you read the history of it, Mona's is there. So she ought to have a reasonable, easy time tracking down at least the influence of that establishment.
And Dawn writes, I was 4 years old. We lived on 27th Avenue in the Sunset. I remember being taken to the World's Fair on a ferry, but I only recall the lights on massive buildings once we got there. It was fine living on 27th Avenue, especially playing in the street and roller skating from Judah down to Irving, grabbing a telephone pole before reaching the traffic. We could play outside all day. I remember the occasional vegetable seller coming along, too. Of course, my mother couldn't work as a teacher then because she was divorced. And there maybe says more than we can even capture here. Thank you all. This has been really a fun and very informative, enlightening hour. We spoke earlier with Michael Nolan, San Francisco resident and genealogist, Marcy Goldstein, director of the National Archives at San Francisco, Kevin Starr, professor of history at USC, his latest book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of the Golden Gate of America's Greatest Bridge, Charles Fracchia, founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum Historical Society, his latest book, When the Water Came Up Montgomery Street, San Francisco During the Gold Rush, and thanks to Nika Smith, who also joined us, and that's Glenn Miller you're hearing, I believe, again, in the mood. Thank you to all, and thank you also to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and our interns, Keith Manconi, Ernesto Morales, Dana Varinsky, and Catalina Villegas. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.